webcam microphone.
Up close, webcam microphone. Up close.
Well, I mean, I guess it's true.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
At the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
all
that guy,
how can that
be possible?
You know, all the days and the lab of choice.
I don't know when that was.
Internet, professional wrestlers,
and not Jesse Ventura style.
It doesn't matter where the cartoon comes from, as long as it's real.
It doesn't.
It's hard to get real information. Because
seriously,
they
don't want you to have
to read two sources whenever I try to prove out one of them. It's not a surprise.
If you expect your government to tell you the truth, you're going to
sadly
disappoint
another one of these things.
Dear Lord, what a dirty old man.
Really
can't
now?
Be serious. Is this
really
one point
things to be
on?
More hooker, you know, eruptions,
eruptions,
whatever.
Like Dave Powers kind of.
Really?
Allegedly broadcast live from FEMA Region 2. Within the borders of the formerly united and currently occupied states of America, we bring you the O'Shelley Effect.
I damn sure know I'm an original. We have all these situations. I'd love to know why it takes 50 years, you know, for...
That's that.
For a 19-year-old girl to eventually get up to gumption to put these things out.
And that is certainly that. February, well, let's see if I can get it right. February the 5th, 2015, the O'Shelley Effect, as the obnoxious bumper tells you. And I'm your host, Chuck O'Shelley, on UCY.TV Radio. We are live. At any rate, one of my favorite topics, funny. My favorite topic, as it were, is the JFK assassination. Don't worry, we are going to get into a lot of other things in the next coming weeks. I promise you that. But one of my favorite topics is certainly the JFK assassination, as anybody who has heard me before anywhere at any time knows. But in upcoming weeks, we're going to cover a lot of different topics, everything from the vaccine industrial complex, as it were, all the way on to, well, probably revisiting JFK again, a little bit of Charles Manson, some comedic type relief here and there, because I get so pissed off when I hear stuff like I had to listen to on Before the First Cup earlier today and had heard previously on mainstream platforms. Anyway. Okay, let me just tell you who's coming up real quick. We do know that Suzanne Poza will be on shortly on Saturday, actually. Roger Landry, who is a reoccurring guest, is going to be on in his normal slot, but we're going to get some insight from some counterintelligence professionals. We're also going to have Dr. Rebecca Carley is going to come on the on Valentine's Day, because I did cancel my St. Valentine's Day massacre special that I was going to do because I'm so extremely aggravated at the whole vaccine issue. Right, Dr. Carley and Leslie Carroll both will both be on that show. We also have one of the makers of the film What in the World Are They Spraying will be coming up. I believe that's on the 17th. Jim DiEugenio will join me on the 19th for at least an hour. Not sure who else will be on that show. Greg Carlwood from the Higher Side Chats is going to join me at some point very, very soon, and we're going to have a long discussion with Frank Gregory Ford on a date yet to be announced regarding his court case, etc., etc. But tonight, like I said, we're going to go back into the JFK discussion, and we're going to do it a little bit differently, not talking about witnesses, not necessarily talking about already published books, but one that is a work in progress. And I have a rather fascinating guest on who I only got to hear about recently. And, you know, it's only been the past, I'd say few months, really, that his name came up. And I found out that it's only been in very recent years that he's been a researcher on the case. But interesting how his views wind up agreeing with the views that I've held for a very, very long time. And seemingly, he's gotten away with not having to stumble through some of the disinformation patches that I've had to over the years. So, who knows? Maybe I'm bowing to a superior intellect tonight. We're going to find out. Carmine Savastano. Okay. That's, is that right? I can't remember. Carmine?
That's right.
Okay, great. Well, hopefully I can get them right when they got a vowel at the end. You know, because I'm thoroughly tired of having my name butchered. But anyway, the reason why Carmine is a bit different from most of the people that I've had on to discuss the JFK topic is because he is also interested in, you know, the rest of the big three that I like to always talk about, which is the JFK, MLK, and RFK assassinations. He is also very, very strict about the level of documentation that he requires before accepting particular stories. Gee, doesn't this all sound familiar to people who've heard me harp and harp on the JFK thing? You know, I'm sorry, I require stuff like evidence and not just fairy tales that people put in books.
Know.
You know, like, well, anyway. Yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress aside. Oh, I said it. Allegedly.
Aside, so much.
Yeah, so many different things. Oh, Barr McClellan, where are you now? Anyway, oh, look, before I get lost in my aggravations, yeah, we're going to talk about the documentation, some of the stuff that people are not aware of that is actually part of the official record that helps to make a hell of a lot of sense out of these fairy tales if you frame it correctly. And here's the amazing part, and I always say this, that you know, you don't rely solely on what's in the government's hands because they're clearly lying to us as much as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. But through their own ineptness, they do tend to leave behind the wonderful, wonderful rabbit trails for us to follow and give us all those wonderful crumbs that they would have left for Hansel and Gretel on the research path to, you know, a pathway out of the woods, as it were. You know, and this is the thing. I mean, even when it came to, like, stuff like MK Ultra, you know, Alan Dulles, the genius that he was, forgot to destroy the financial documents, right?
Yep.
You know, gee, I wonder why they're spending all this money on this research project over here that, yeah, you made mistakes, Mr. Dulles, and, you know, hopefully you're sitting at the very same poker table that, you know, Adolf Hitler and some other people that I have personally known in my life are occupying at the moment, continuously losing. But, anyway, enough jokes aside, Carmine, I want to give you this time to kind of just tell people, you know, ostensibly who you are if nobody's ever heard of you before or if somebody's never heard of you before, you know, where they can find you on the internet, and I'll probably ask you again for that later so that we can, you know, give people a place to listen to you besides where you have to compete with my running mouth. So go right ahead.
I really appreciate the opportunity, Chuck. People can look up the book and information that I have on TPAK.com. It's TPAAK.com, and it stands for Two Princes and a King, which is the title of the book. They can also find me on Facebook.com/NEEP, capital MG, which is Neapolis Media Group. It's a small publishing house that I'm working on building up with some volunteers and other committed researchers. So I'm, like you said, more recent to the case. I went into a lot of the forums and watched for a while. I thought that that was probably the smartest thing to do because I have seen a lot of people just charge in and things don't go very well for them.
Well, right. And, you know, I took that attitude, but way earlier, you know, when they had what they called, ready for me to date myself nicely, when they had something they called message boards, you know, we would put up stuff on the message board and then somebody else would put up stuff on it to argue with our stuff. And that's where this stuff all came from. Even our wonderful friend, Professor McAdams, who is, you know, facing dismissal at this point. You know, and just on that particular issue, just really quickly, and I'm speaking just for myself here, talk about having mixed feelings, man. You know, I've got the same problem when it comes to Vince Bugliosi and the fact that he's got the, you know, the whole treatise against George W. Bush, but at the same time he writes that, you know, abomination of a cinder block of a book, you know, reclaiming history. So it's like I abandon all of his stuff. And weirdly, the more I dig into it, I mean, with him as a prosecutor, it makes me sympathize with Charles Manson. So
I liked his book on Manson. That was okay.
Yeah, well, fortunate for all of us, he didn't write it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there are claims that, okay, sorry. You knew where I was going, didn't you?
Yeah, I had an inkling.
And Vince Bugliosi will not get on a recording with me under any circumstances, okay? Just wanted that known that he absolutely declared that because I went on a letter-writing campaign. And apparently somebody presented it to him because he got printed a few editorials some years back when Tom Hanks and Playtone were developing what wound up being a CNN production about the assassination. But initially it was supposed to be something for your home box office. And, man, he was not happy with me and absolutely wouldn't even have a conversation with me, not even for 5 minutes. So,
well, I suppose that shows you how much he's willing to listen to other people's ideas.
Yeah, well, you know. I mean, and the Jesse Ventura clip is priceless. I mean, Ventura I don't agree with on a whole host of things.
Yeah.
But you gotta love that clip where he said, turn the camera off. You know, but, oh, okay. Enough is enough with all that. So, let's get down to the brass tacks here. You know, I do want to let you finish about the forums because you went into the forums and you saw what was going on and a lot of this stuff where people are just arguing with each other and there are the lone nut supporters, then there are the what we would even refer to as the seriously fringe conspiracy people, you know, the Jackie Kennedy probably killed JFK people,
yeah.
You know, the
confetti cannon people.
The confetti cannon, there you go, all of that stuff. And meanwhile, grouped in with that are all these legitimate people that were reaching out and trying to get their points across and find new information and interface with others, you know, network with others, as it were, to really bring out the truth about the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find this about all of these subjects. I mean, even with the King assassination, even with the you know Bobby Kennedy assassination, to a lesser degree the Malcolm X assassination, but nevertheless there is always this like three-tiered kind of thing that goes on in cyberspace. So you found that, and then what happened?
Well, I watched for a while. And then I started to, you know, as we all do, develop my opinions about certain people who posted and others who posted. And I tried to follow the ones that I thought had a decent idea. And probably about a month or two into lurking, as they call it, I realized that a lot of the threads would sometimes get caught at one point and just basically turn upon themselves and begin again. And then it was just, you know, two people who hadn't been arguing about one issue decided to take up the issue that had already been argued about for 10 pages and start arguing about that again. So what I did was I went into the primary documents myself. I definitely have learned from other people, and I hope that I've helped other people learn things, but I realized that unless I looked at the primary documents myself, I was never going to understand it without interpretation. All of us, I think, whether unintentionally or not, we interpret the evidence. And when we offer it to other people, sometimes our interpretation can mislead. You know, not necessarily, you know, a big misleading, but just the slightest thing wrong or the slightest misquotation. And then you get things that spin out of control. For instance, like the Secret Service agents that were seen in Dealey Plaza. All the different various ways that I've discussed with you before about And, you know, you told me about that they could have been, who they could have been.
Right.
I think that that can all be explained much to chaos and other factors rather than it having to be nefarious. So I think a lot of people, if they don't go to the evidence, they go to various authors. And I think there are some great authors out there. And, you know, I aspire to be among them. But I don't think that we are the definitive answer. I think the definitive answer is in the evidence. And then you can read people's books and see if you agree or not.
Well, right, and this is what goes on. There's a lot of interpretation, and it is subject to, you know, the in the eye of the beholder, as they say, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is part of the problem. And, of course, these authors, in a lot of cases, they sort of marry themselves to a theory and then seem to seek evidence to fit into that puzzle, as it were. You know, instead of, you know, simply following the evidence and developing a storyline from the evidence based on itself. So, of course, we all have to go back to these primary documents. And it amazes me sometimes that that so many people that make comments about this stuff have never actually read the things they're commenting about.
Exactly.
You know, I'll give you the best, for instance, which is constantly out on alternative media, and I know this is off the topic, and then I promise you we're going to get right into the documents.
Whatever you want to talk about, Chuck. We got lots of time.
We got plenty of time, but here's the worst thing out there right now in alternative media, and it's been out there for well over a decade, easily, probably actually well over two decades if you count people like Bill Cooper. You know, the idea that Kennedy was killed because he was issuing silver certificates.
The Federal Reserve thing,
which I would like to believe, because I think the Federal Reserve is an anathema to freedom in this country, and that is part of my, you know, my stance directly. But here's the problem. When they point to this executive order, okay, this executive order 11110, okay, they're totally misrepresenting what it is and misreading it.
And, yeah, now, unfortunately, we have to deal with all of the theories that have come off of that misreading.
Well, right. And here's the thing. You know, it's like, well, he was the only one who did it, just like Lincoln. Now, the Lincoln point is valid.
Well, yeah.
Okay. But
I just think the comparisons that people always make, you know, the secretaries, all the, you know, locational things that Lincoln and Kennedy were similar in.
Well, there is a lot of weird similarities there, and I grant them those weird similarities. You know, the fact that, you know, Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln, Lincoln's secretary was named Kennedy. These are truths, I mean.
Oh, yeah, no. I agree that you know, there are weird things that you can associate between them. I just don't think that they're of real consequence.
Well, exactly. And this whole thing about, you know, having issued this, you know, constitutional money, et cetera, is absolutely wrong. First of all, Kennedy was not the first one to submit it. I pulled out of the current money circulation a couple of years ago these United States notes to show people that they were printed long before Kennedy was even a congressman. Okay? The next thing is, oh, well, these bills disappeared immediately after the assassination. Also not true. If you check with the you know, the Bureau of Engraving and so on, you'll find that these things were printed all the way up to 1971. And the reason why it stopped in 1971 is because Richard Nixon took the final steps to remove us from the gold standard, which related to, you know, that was the last semblance of any sort of backing the money against anything. And even though that was kind of a sham in and of itself, it made the printing of the U.S. notes, which were backed by silver, absolutely superfluous. So therefore, this is what really happened there. It's got nothing to do with the timing of the assassination. And in reality, he actually took an executive privilege, which was to print these notes, and turn it over to his Secretary of Treasury.
Yeah.
So this wasn't them taking power away. Actually, through that executive order, he gave away some power, which makes sense in that the Silver Purchase Act had just been repealed, okay, and there was a change in climate in that we no longer had on reserve, on deposit in these banks, you know, enough silver to justify these things, you know, being in as great a circulation as they were, so they were reduced in their amounts. There's a whole lot of things going on there, but one of the things that's not going on is some revolutionary act that he did that would cause a serious upset among the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my whole objection to ideas like that is that they rely on too many people. You know, it's not, I don't believe, and I'm sure this is heretical to say among some people who do support a conspiracy, but I do not believe in any large group doing this. I don't think it was the whole FBI or the whole CIA or the whole government or the whole mafia. It doesn't make any sense. You can't have so many people and keep a plot to yourself. I think the old saying from Benjamin Franklin was, if you want to keep a plot between three men, kill two. And I do believe Carlos Marcello later used that himself.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And this is exactly correct also. And it does sound strange, and I get a lot of pushback from people that are conspiracy-oriented based on the same idea. But here's the thing. You can compartmentalize this.
Exactly.
Simply because, you know, three or four men actually controlled the events that led to the assassination.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean that 10,000 didn't join in on the cover-up, but it doesn't mean that they intended to join in on the cover-up for the sake of protecting those four men.
Exactly.
A lot of them, you know, Doug Horn, who I have plenty of objections to, but makes an excellent point regarding this, that a lot of people that are working for these bureaucracies were in a go-along-to-get-along kind of state. So you have a whole lot of, you know, government officials, government workers, as they were in different positions, who were doing things simply because they were ordered to,
yeah.
Who were doing things under false pretense. I mean, for God's sake, Earl Warren was drafted into this whole thing, and, you know, the guy who the Warren Report is, you know, ostensibly named after, although that's not the correct name.
Yeah. I say President's Commission, and people look at me like I don't know what I'm talking about.
Right, but that's the actual name of the document. You know, but the Warren, you know, Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was pretty much drafted into this by
mm-hmm.
being told that, and this we can prove, that he was being told that, you know, look, if we don't kind of put this to bed real quick, we're going to have the American people speculating that the Russians did this, and
mm-hmm.
We're going to have a nuclear war on our hands.
Mm-hmm. National security, as always.
Well, right, and this is always the thing from on high, is that for the sake of national security, we need to behave in this way, so on and so forth. So well-meaning people who were working within that apparatus certainly, you know, willingly participated in the cover-up, but not necessarily to protect, you know, the four people that actually, you know, murdered this man in broad daylight, but really to protect what they believed was, you know, the nation's best interests. For one reason or another. So, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't agree with his assessment, but I'm happy to see the admission. There was a recent article from Politico where David Slosson came out and says that he now believes there was feasibly a conspiracy.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot. You know,
I know, but it only took 50 years.
it only took half a century for you to get down to that.
But,
you know.
Some people got mad when I posted that as if it didn't mean anything. And I understand that to us, where we supported it and where we have dug in the evidence, it isn't a big meaningful thing. But to the average person, it is. The average person, that's a person on the commission saying they were probably wrong. And that still has some weight to it.
Well, right. But, you know, but it falls on deaf ears, honestly, Carmine, because over the years – we have had admissions from various commission members who didn't buy, you know, the story as it was.
True.
We've had Gerald Ford admitting just before his death, you know, that he knew he was, you know, being misled by the agency.
Mm-hmm.
We have Ford also simply because he saved too many of his own pieces of paper, showing us that he essentially changed the language in the Warren Commission report. To misrepresent where the back wound was on Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, over the years, these things have come out, and quite honestly, people still go, oh, that's interesting. Well, I still buy it, or, you know, or, nah, I think the mob killed him, or, you know, or, oh, you know what, Lyndon Johnson probably did it. You know, they still,
we're still on that, you know? Yeah, well, I think that, hopefully, I mean, what I'm going to try to do, and I know that other authors have done and tried to do, is I'm going to try to bring together as much evidence. I think that, you know, I'm going to, of course, present what I think is the most feasible scenario, my ideas, but I'm also going to say that they're not definitive. I think a lot of authors make the mistake you were saying earlier of marrying themselves to an idea, and they will not change it based on the evidence. We have to. We have to always adjust our ideas to the new evidence, and there's always going to be new evidence. I mean, there's, what, you know, 10 million or more files. Some of them range from 3 to 500 pages.
Right.
So there's always going to be another nugget of gold that somebody is able to find eventually if they keep reading.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you sent me some of these files that we're going to talk about tonight, or links to them, I should say. And, man, these are some great points of discussion. I don't know if you want to take them in order the way you sent them to me, or...
Sure, sure, that's fine.
Because, and if you don't mind, I'll just kind of give people an idea here. I mean...
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, we have... Well, let me just read what you put here, and then I'll add my little commentary to it, and then we'll get into what you see, okay?
Sure.
Okay, number one, a Central Intelligence Agency list of officials with knowledge or connected to the Castro assassination plots. Okay, among the names are Alan Dulles, who now is demonstrable supposed knowledge of these relevant plots from the commission and its investigators. Another notable assassination is the multiple CIA agents involved that were former FBI. Okay, now, first of all, Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA before Kennedy fired him, who magically winds up being the most active member of the Warren Commission. Thank you very much. You know, gee, I wonder why he's important here. Okay. Yeah,
they didn't really do conflict of interest inquiries back then.
No, certainly not. And even if you look at the basic... the construct there of the commission is interesting enough. I mean, you've got people that are opposed to Kennedy all over that thing.
Yeah.
You know, for one reason or another. I mean, Earl Warren was practically the most the most neutral party there. You know, Gerald Ford, in my estimation, was nothing more than an FBI snitch to make sure that Hoover kept well informed.
Yeah.
You know, and also weird pick because just the representative from Michigan. You know, what is the significance of this guy? But, I mean, even if you look at Cooper...
You underestimate the drawing power of Michigan.
Well, you know, and again, the only guy who was ever to be president who wasn't elected to be president or vice president.
Donnie on the spot.
Yeah, just happened to be there. Ay, ay, ay. Anyway, we'll leave Gerald Ford alone. I mean, enough kicking the dead horse, as it were. But, okay, so... This interesting little nugget comes from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Segregated CIA files, right?
Yep.
Okay. And just for the clarification of the listener, once again, this is that wonderful commission which was assembled in the mid-70s to once again reevaluate the evidence regarding the JFK and the MLK assassinations. There were separate committees for each. But at the end of the day, a guy named G. Robert Blakey wound up being the head of it, although there was a guy named Richard Sprague at the beginning who seemed to actually be interested in doing a real investigation. But anyway, of course, he didn't last very long, and a guy named Robert Tannenbaum, and I would suggest the listeners look up these individuals and see what it is they had to say about it. But anyway, let's get to the documentation.
Okay, so basically what this document reveals is everyone that knew about the Castro assassination plots, largely from its inception, it lists among the people Sheffield Edwards, Robert Mayhew, basically a cast of characters that seems to constantly pop up throughout agency operations throughout the late 50s into the 60s. Now, among the people who knew and the person who authorized it was Alan Dulles. Dulles never told the rest of the commission anything about any of this. So Dulles suppressed evidence that I think was relevant. I think most people would imagine it's relevant since it's an assassination plot. and it was ongoing before and after the Kennedy assassination. ZR Rifle got reauthorized by Richard Helms in 60, I believe it was 63. He reauthorized it in the beginning of 63.
Right, and ZR Rifle, I don't know if you want to give people sort of a summary explanation of ZR Rifle, because this has been one of those things that has gone back and forth and, you know, has been debated about, because a lot of people say, well, what the hell does, you know, and meanwhile I'm playing, you know, not devil's advocate, but idiot's advocate here. What the hell does a Castro plot have to do with killing Kennedy, right?
Yeah.
But they say that, and then they say, well, what is ZR Rifle anyway?
Basically, the Castro plots were divided into two sections, Phase 1 and Phase 2. Phase 1 was the portion when they used Robert Mayhew to contact mafia leaders and try to come up with ideas of how to off Castro. The agency originally wanted to have them do a gangland assassination on Castro, and Trafficante and Giancana both said no, because they said that nobody could live through that, they'd be killed, so nobody would take the job. So they tried, you know, poison, they kicked a few things around, nothing ever really came of it, and then the project was handed off to William Harvey, which began Phase 2. Phase 2 included ZR Rifle. ZR Rifle was a program that was set up to, it basically militarized the Castro plots. Instead of using poison or something a little more subtle, Harvey decided assassination groups, sabotage, things like that.
Well, right, and it is from this very same type of stuff that other plots can be born. I mean, the utilization of the organization that's laid out in ZR Rifle, which we still don't have all the documentation on.
Nope.
Okay,
some
so don't...
Notes. That's about it. Some of the notes and maybe a few documents here and there that I've seen. But
right.
In that documentation, in the notes, one of the points that often people talk about and some critics of conspiracy like to say is that there's no proof. Well, in the ZR Rifle notes, it talks about the alteration of documents, about false 201 files, about changing things so that nobody will ever know what's really going on. So it is that it's not just an idea. They did it. It's in their files.
Right. They absolutely did it. And, of course, when people take a look at the, you know, the 201 file of Lee Harvey Oswald as it's been released to the public, you know, anybody who has studied these files before in, you know, an intact file can tell you that this file is really strange looking. The individuals that wound up handling that file, because you can actually trace that if you know how. Mm-hmm. You can look at, people pass right by that first sheet, don't they, Carmine? which tells you who actually handled this thing ostensibly. I'm not saying that that's a complete list, but it gives you an idea of which sections these people were from and everything else. And when you start to look at it, a lot of things don't make sense. The Oswald 201 file is at best incomplete. Okay, and it's probably, I've gotten some argument from people, but I'm telling you, it's probably a complete fabrication.
It's anything is possible. I don't know if it would be a complete fabrication, but I definitely know there are things missing. I'll have to have you remind me, but I can send you a document, one of the things I'm going to have in the book, and I'm trying to recall if it's between 20 and 30, but there's 20 to 30 known missing items. Things that the agency knew were supposed to be there that were not. So what happened to all those documents? And why were... If Oswald is just the lone gunman, as officials allege, why is there any need to remove the items?
Well, see, that's the thing. Is, you know, people say, well, he's got a 201 file, therefore he's an agent. That's not true.
Huh.
But the thing is, if he is just a person of interest to the CIA and they create a personnel file for him, there's no reason to redact the information or literally pull things out of it, which are guaranteed to be missing. I mean, I've never heard as high a number as you're citing there,
yeah.
But I know for a fact there's more than a dozen things that are missing. From my own look at it, again, I'm not a document expert per se. But I know enough to know that there's more than one dozen items missing from that 201 file. So, again, although I may not be as strong on the point as you are, I'm telling you, there's something really, really wrong with that file, and that's a guarantee.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. There's, I mean, like I said, I'll send you that document, but, and you know, it's just a brief bio of the missing things. It doesn't really go into exactly what they stated or anything. It just said that all of these things, you know, I mean, I think some were biographic material, some were travel material. I don't necessarily think that they were all very important things, but what is the need to purge dozens of documents if he's just another, you know, person of interest? They don't do that for all the other files. Why would they do that specifically for his?
Well, right, and I've always contended that, you know, the withholding from the government, both the known and the unknown withholdings, as they are, point to nothing else but a serious suspicion. Because if this guy was simply a lone nut who wanted to make sure that his name appeared in the history books, there would be absolutely no cause for our government to withhold any information about him.
Well, yeah, and, you know, also, how does he come into contact so many times? Is it coincidence that he comes into contact with intelligence officers or FBI agents or members of the government over and over everywhere he goes? You know, is it coincidence that he is somehow able, just following the Cold War, or during the Cold War, I should say, just following the Red Scare, to immigrate to Russia, marry someone, and then come back with his family on a State Department loan? I don't think that they prove that, you know, he is a government agent. I don't think they prove any of the fringe things that people might claim. But I think, how many coincidences can happen? You know, how can it all just be luck over and over? How does he somehow, as where the Rosenbergs got the chair, mm-hmm. how is this guy able to dance back and forth across the ocean with no problem?
Well, yeah, that's one of the really weird things about him, is that he gets away with a lot of other things. I mean, beginning with his Marine discharge. You know, that's a strange kind of setup, especially coming out of, you know, the work that we do know he was doing, and they still haven't let us know all about that, even though the U-2, you know, program is completely useless to national security at this point. Yeah. You know,
there are no valid security reasons anymore. Do they really think that the Russians don't know something that we've done after the 50 years has passed already? I think enough has come out.
Well, right. And that's the other strange thing, because national security, well, you know, let's assume that they're correct. It is about national security. That makes it worse, you know, because now you're telling me that this guy was somehow, information about this one particular guy is relevant to national security. So what does that imply?
Yeah, you know, purpose. He serves some purpose of national security.
Right, right. And therefore, you're hanging yourself with your own reasoning. You know, this is why I can't let it go, you know,
yeah.
regarding this guy. Because otherwise, I think he played, you know, virtually no role in the actual killing itself.
Well, I think that Oswald, you know, I'm very torn because, unfortunately, we have the people that want to claim either he is totally guilty or he is totally innocent, and I don't think he's either. I think he is more likely in the middle. I think he is the patsy he claimed to be. I think, you know, and these are just my views. I don't think this is definitive. I'm just offering what I've gotten from the evidence. I think that he was likely part of some plan, but he had no clue what it really was. Oswald strikes me as a person who thought he was smarter than he was. He really believed that he had a handle on all these various things he was doing, and he didn't understand what the end game was.
Right. I think he had absolutely no idea what the end game was. And you can glean that from a lot of things. The primary evidence, if you watch this guy's body language after he's been arrested, if you take into account and you believe even half of the stories that were told by the people that interrogated him, this guy was one of these people who really did think he was a whole lot smarter and a whole lot swifter than he really was.
Yeah.
And seems to me that he was ripe for the picking for somebody that needed a convenient fall guy.
Oh, he was perfect. I mean, what I refer to as Oswald, I call it his communist veneer. He has a very, very communist veneer about him. He, you know, he says he's a communist. Well, he doesn't say he's a communist. He associates with communists. He says he's a Marxist. He says he believes all these things. But if you notice, he never attends a meeting. He never actually goes out and, besides the flyer incident in New Orleans, he really doesn't ever do anything that a Marxist or a communist would do.
Well, there is. Yeah, there is the possibility that he handed out flyers elsewhere, but the Fair Play for Cuba committee is not exactly the first stop for somebody who is a Marxist-Leninist.
Yeah.
As he publicly proclaimed to be.
Yeah, I mean, and or, you know, they, if he was, I've been into debates with people where they talk about what a, you know, he was an active member, this and that. No, he wasn't. You know, he, that was a fake chapter in New Orleans. It
yeah, he. We actually have the documentation to show that he wanted to start a chapter, but was never actually officially approved for it.
Yeah.
And just kind of did this on his own, which is another sort of weird thing that happened with the guy. That, again, if you look at some documentation, you can find out that just coincidentally at that time, there was a program out there among the intelligence community to do precisely this kind of work to discredit those organizations. Because this is post-Red Scare, and the Fair Play for Cuba committee specifically, which hardly anybody in this country really knew about.
Yeah. Yeah, the FPCC was blown up way beyond any importance that it truly had. You know, it wasn't the leading Marxist or communist organization that the commission or others might have tried to make it. It was just another group. I mean, it was considered subversive, of course, but Hoover considered anybody that got in the way of his agenda subversive.
Well, right, and it wasn't even the leading pro-Castro group in the country at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're talking about poor placement for this guy, really. You know, and it almost seems like that would be something where somebody thinks they're smarter than they are.
Yeah.
Thinks they're doing something important.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't argue with you there. So,
you know, and it just, all of his actions seem to come back to that over and over. You know, it would make sense if there was some sort of linear progression, but there isn't. You know, he's saying he's a Marxist here, but he's not doing any, for instance, you know, and I don't think that personal experience is definitive by any means, but when I was in college, I actually met some Marxists, and they were always active, always doing charity events, always, you know, trying to get their word out. They didn't just make big shows a couple of times and then just tell people they were Marxists. They acted like them. And he never struck me in any of his actions as a true Marxist. He would complain about the system, but he wouldn't actually do anything to change it.
Well, right, and that's something that is absolutely correct. That a true person who believes in the Marxist philosophy, which is different than what the typical communist agenda would be.
Yeah.
Okay. And he does point that out during the interview. But again, you know, like the famous interview on WDSU, which you know, this is where his public proclamations about the Fair Play for Cuba committee, you know, post his arrest in New Orleans and all that. This is what goes on there. But here's the thing. He makes that point, but I don't even think he has a follow-up because they go, well, what's the difference, basically? And he goes, well,
He didn't know. He had never been a member. He didn't have a chapter.
Well, right. And he goes, well, it's the difference between, like, this country and that country. And this is a guy grasping,
yeah,
trying to get, well, I kind of know, but I don't want to sound dumb. So this is what it's like. There's so many televisions here. And then and it goes into that whole thing, which nobody ever addresses that. But that always cracks me up because that is the hallmark of somebody who doesn't even understand the position that they're trying to espouse.
Yep, he's on a need-to-know basis.
Yeah, right. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, no, I think that that's why I say the veneer. It's, you know, he strikes me as someone who definitely had an alternate agenda. Now, whether that agenda was his personal agenda or someone else's agenda remains the question. But I think that he didn't act like, for instance, when he went to Bringier and he tried to convince him, basically tried to infiltrate the Cuban exile movement. You know,
why
is he doing that? I think Bringier's quote was, he thought he was either a communist trying to get information or an FBI penetration agent.
Well, right, and for those that don't know, Carlos Berenguer was the guy, and I probably just mispronounced his name, but oh well. Carlos Berenguer was the guy who he ends up in a scuffle with on the streets in New Orleans, okay? And this is the famous incident where he goes to him first earlier that day or the day before, I forget which, and actually tries to offer his services mm-hmm. to these anti-Castro Cubans. And if you've seen the movie JFK, it is dramatized in there pretty well. And now, the funny thing, of course, is that he winds up getting arrested after this seemingly, you know, really superficial kind of physical confrontation in the streets. And he winds up paying a $10 fine, and he's the only one who's actually fined, you know, out of the group of guys that were involved in this scuffle that really went nowhere. And there's a whole bunch of weird things about that, but meanwhile, he's basically gone to the anti-Castro Cubans, offered himself as, you know, a former Marine, somebody who can help them out. I think he even left his field manual with Berenguer at some point there. And then it turns up on the street nearby, handing out pro-Castro literature. So he's all over the map, and yeah, Berenguer, who was kind of experienced with this kind of thing and was rabidly anti-Castro, you know,
his brother was one of the people in the Bay of Pigs.
There you go. So he had a personal reason for it, but he was also, he was active. Again, these guys are always active. When you have somebody that's you know, concerned with a very narrow political agenda like that, you're always going to find their activities. It's always traceable. And even long before we had the electronic age, you could certainly find what type of associations these people had and everything else. And, of course, Oswald has none of them.
Yep.
So
they're all very there's a lot of assumptions that people make about him. And, you know, I often, you know, people call him a communist, people call him a Marxist, but there's no proof. There's just these, you know, little actions he takes here and there to try to build up his communist veneer, but there really isn't one. There's no substance to it. Even when he's in Russia, he complains about that there are, you know, greedy party bosses over here, just like there are back in America. He complains about the winters. You know, how committed is he really to the cause?
Right. And special note, he never did even join the Communist Party while living in the Soviet Union.
Exactly. Because, you know, there's all sorts of people who didn't join the Communist Party in the 60s who lived in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Generally, not something you do. Yeah, I know. It's entirely... It's just frustrating to have to deal with that kind of logic sometimes, you know, where people don't understand this. But okay, let's try not to
the document.
Yeah, let's go back to the documents. But they always lead somewhere, Carmine. I'm sorry.
Hey, that's fine. So, but yeah, no, I think the most important thing about this first document is that Dulles suppressed the evidence. That to me compromises the commission off the bat. It can't even trust its own members. So how could it trust its conclusion?
And if you take a look at, you know, the best easily referenced book I can think of about this is Walt Brown's The War on Omission. If you take a look at what would you call that? He kind of puts together the activities of the commissioners and really correlates them directly to, you know, how often they spoke, how many questions they asked, things like that. And guess who is the most active member of the Warren Commission?
Dulles.
Alan Dulles. It might as well have been called the Dulles Commission. Okay, so and Walt is dead on about that. I mean, for years and years, I thought that trying to read through the executive sessions because just the way, you know, and that's just what's on the record, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, there's more to it, but what's on the record officially is that Dulles was controlling the whole investigation.
Well, I can't even believe that they allowed what is in the meeting minutes to remain in the meeting minutes, like the part where in one of the executive sessions. I can't remember if it's Boggs or I think it's Boggs. Someone asks him if we were to – it's Boggs or McCloy. They ask him if we question the FBI or the CIA about Oswald and him possibly working for them, will they admit it? And Dulles says no. Of course course they won't. No, of course they won't admit.
Right. Which, you know, again, but he never expected anybody to be able to read that stuff, so.
Exactly. Well, and he also suggested that at the end of one of them to destroy all the notes, and apparently that didn't happen.
Yeah, well, we only have the one missing executive session that we know of, but. Right. Anyway, so, but now I want to get on to something else, because this to me is so important, because this doesn't just have to do with the Kennedy assassination at all. Okay, this has to do, you can relate it to that, but you can relate it to a whole lot of other things. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is the Guide to Assassinations, okay? And this is often referred to as like an assassination manual.
Yeah.
Okay. But let me just read what you wrote down here. Created by an unnamed agency's operatives. It details suggested methods of dispatching people with various means. It also includes...
that should be.
it also includes used of lost assassins. Okay, use of lost assassins that kept ignorant of the final plan before they are sacrificed. In other words, and it's just, you know, I read terribly when I'm trying to do it on the air anyway, Carmine, so sorry about that.
Don't worry about it. I had a typo in there somewhere, I'm sure.
Maybe, but doesn't matter. If you didn't make one, I'll make one anyway with my mouth. So, but here's the deal, is that it essentially tells them about how to make disposable patsies.
Exactly.
This is the key. Sorry.
Yeah, there are some very interesting connections, I believe, in these documents. They were crafted, and there's no date on them. They're included in the same papers as the Guatemala documents from the National Security Agency Archive at Georgetown University. Basically, it is the agency's best attempt to put together all the information they can about how to kill people. My nickname for it is the murder guide.
Yeah.
That basically is what it is. It's how to make murders look better. You can make murders look like accidents. You can choose the type of patsy you want, the type of weapon you want. And there's a few excerpts that I just wanted to go over with you and see what you thought. Here's the first one. No assassination instruction should ever be written or recorded. Decision and instruction should be confined to an absolute minimum of persons. Ideally, only one person will be involved. No report may be made, but usually the act will be properly covered by normal news services whose output is available to all concerned. So, in that section, I think it's fairly self-explanatory. Keep this operation small. Don't put anything on paper, which they often failed to do. They just couldn't help themselves.
Right.
The manual existing would be...
would be the primary example. Thanks. See, go ahead.
They talk about one assassin if possible. Only try to use one if you can.
Well, right, because a lone guy screaming that this is a plot against them is kind of meaningless.
Exactly.
You know, when you have, like, five guys standing there going, listen, I'm telling you now that these other four guys, I don't even know them, you know. Mm-hmm. That might provide, you know, somebody who wanted to actually investigate the situation, you know, with an out for, you know, hanging it on five guys. But one guy... Hey, it's his word against
everybody
all of
else.
Us,
yep.
You know, so it makes it a lot easier to have a singular fall guy. And of course, you don't want to leave things on paper because God help you if you find it again. Well, but I do find it ironic that the manual exists.
Yeah, exactly. I try to tell people, you know, they say there's no way they'd leave stuff like that behind. No, they would.
Yeah.
It's just a question of numbers. You know, people talk about how can you trust the official documents? Well, a large number of them can be trusted because they didn't have time to alter them. You can't alter millions of files that you don't know exist.
And they also did not believe that a lot of these things would ever see the light of day, so...
Exactly. They thought everybody would be dead and no one would care anymore.
Right. And in this manual, by the way, there is stuff about, you know, looking like accidents. Yeah, they even mentioned that suicides...
Mm-hmm. The best way to fake a drowning...
the best way to fake drownings. you know, there's all kinds of stuff in here.
Well, another one was for people who are alcoholics, you can dope them up with extra drugs and then inject a small amount of alcohol into them so that it appears like alcohol poisoning.
Right, exactly. You know, and there's all sorts of wonderful little tactics. And meanwhile, gee, why would this be included in the Guatemala papers?
Likely, they might have tried a few things during PV success.
Yeah, that's about where we're at, huh?
The next part, I think, plays into what you were talking about that expendable assassin. The techniques employed will vary according to whether the subject is unaware of his danger, aware but unguarded, or guarded. If the assassin is to die with the subject, the act will be called lost. If the assassin is to escape, the adjective will be safe. It should be noted that no compromises should exist here. The assassin must not fall alive into enemy hands.
Well, and isn't that interesting right there?
Mm-hmm.
Because, gee, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald, most famously to my knowledge, was the first person to ever be killed on television live.
Yep.
Okay, so...
Less than 72 hours after the alleged crimes he committed?
Which is interesting, too, because... Go ahead.
So, yeah, where are we? The next part, further type division is caused by the need to conceal the fact that the subject was actually the victim of assassination, rather than an accident or natural causes. If such concealment is desirable, this goes back to our accident part, the operation will be called secret, while if assassination requires publicity to be effective, it will be termed terroristic. Assassinations usually involve clandestine agents or members of criminal organizations.
Right. Now, see how versatile that is. We can make it look like terrorism. We can make it look like, you know, a political action. We can make it look like, you know, it was... Go ahead.
Make it look like a criminal hit?
Or a criminal hit, and that's fine. And, of course, in the same manual, they also discuss the recruiting of criminal elements, don't they?
Yep. They talk about using them to basically be the fall guys for their operations. And yep. I think that's another goes back to the Castro plots. It's a dangerous game they played, and I think they underestimated with whom they were playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think in a lot of cases, the intellectuals at the agency with many interesting titles thought that they were far smarter than they were, much like Oswald. They underestimated, in my view, the Cuban exiles and the mafia. I think they really thought that they could control them, and there was no chance that was going to happen.
Yep, this is absolutely true. And, you know, and again, this is not to say that either Carmine or myself believe that, you know, the mob did it people are correct here.
No.
It's just to say that, well, they were not the controllers, you know, progenitors of the whole situation, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Could people that were linked to La Cosa Nostra been involved in some way? Absolutely.
Yeah, I think any of the three groups, people from any of the three, or perhaps a small group of all three, you know, it's just the potential was never there until the agency opened Pandora's box.
Which they did with ZR Rifle.
Yep.
So there you go. This is why this all makes sense, just in case you're keeping score at home. Okay.
Okay. The next section, when the decision to assassinate has been reached, the tactics of the operation must be planned based upon an estimate of the situation similar to one used in a military operations. When all necessary data has been collected and the effective tactical plan can be prepared, all planning must be mental. No paper should ever contain evidence of the operation.
Now, this leads back to, well, okay, if there were plotters involved with, you know, with Oswald, how come there's no connections to him? Because generally speaking, a small meeting of individuals where verbal ideas are exchanged, people are meant to keep things memorized, you know, this is typical.
They're not going to keep extensive notes. Some people talk about that there should be all this evidence. I think that there'll be a lot of peripheral evidence. I think that there'll be trails we can follow and, you know, substantiations we can make, but there's not going to be a smoking gun. It's going to be what I think the best chance of us proving a conspiracy is doing using this at least the standard of the commission or higher. If we can build a preponderance of evidence that proves there's a conspiracy, that pretty much negates much of what the commission claimed.
Mm-hmm. Nope, absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, you know, later on, people say, well, you know, okay, the House Select Committee, you know, found that there was the high probability of a conspiracy. But, of course, this is discounted by the fact that, you know, there was the acoustics evidence, and maybe that's not so solid. And I'm not here to argue that issue.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
I think as far as the acoustics evidence, you know, I'm more than willing when I debate people who criticize any thought of conspiracy. Sure, go ahead. Okay, so we don't have the acoustics evidence. That's not the majority of the evidence. The acoustics evidence was just what they attached later on to try to prove that fourth shot. Mm-hmm. And even if there wasn't a fourth shot, that doesn't prove there was only one assassin. You know, I mean, it's the preponderance of evidence, I think, that the HSCA was relying on, it, you know, people try to say that it turned upon the acoustics evidence. It didn't. There were tons of connections that were established that the commission failed to make. You know, they didn't know that the FBI basically went to sleep. They didn't know that the CIA sat on its hands. They didn't understand that they were being undercut by their own people.
Right. Right. And, of course, the investigative arm of the Warren Commission was the FBI.
Yeah.
You know, that's all there is to it.
Yeah, they had no chance. Yeah. They were compromised from the beginning. And I think a lot of people... you know, like we talked about earlier on both sides. I think, you know, there are those that are committed to the commission, and there are those that are committed to the story they've accepted, and they will never agree, and they will never give up what they've believed, and that's not going to lead anywhere. The only way we're going to find out new things is if there are reasonable people on both sides that can discuss these things.
Oh, right. And of course, if you have an expertise regarding, you know, the commission from either side, there are plenty of fair-minded things to be said, both as positives and negatives.
Oh, yeah. But we wouldn't have half the things we do. You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you if you were...
It's okay. Go ahead.
I think that there's a lot of things that would have been lost without the commission. Some people don't know and some people don't realize... Hoover just wanted an FBI investigation. He didn't want a commission. A commission was Katzenbach's idea. And Hoover and Johnson were opposed to it. Now, I don't know why, you know, whether it was Robert Kennedy or whoever was getting Katzenbach to talk about a commission, but Johnson and Hoover just wanted a nice, quick FBI report, and it's over. You know, Hoover gets to deal with everything, nobody really gets to know anything, and we move on.
Right, and if you want to look at exactly what the FBI wanted to present, go ahead and take a look at the Gimberling report. That was what they had come up with right away.
Yeah, I know, because, you know, an investigation only takes a few days.
Mm. Yeah, of course. Man, oh, man.
It does if you have the end already written for you.
Well, exactly. If you know your conclusion, all you got to do is find a couple of pieces of evidence to back it up, and you're done.
As we know, some authors operate upon those methods as well.
Yeah. Oh, you knew where I was going with it. Okay. So, all right. This in and of itself, and I'm just going to say this to the listener, and I dropped the link in the chat for both of the documents that we've discussed so far, but that document alone, I advise you to read it and read it very carefully, because what happens here with this assassination manual, as it were, is, you know, you're looking at the standard operating procedure. I mean, yeah. You really are, and that can be applied to a lot of things, not just the Kennedy assassination.
Nope.
You know,
similar to MLK and RFK, in my opinion.
Exactly. I this is why it's, you know, to me, there is no question that there was agency involvement in all three.
There had to have been at least someone who knew agency tactics. I wouldn't necessarily say it was, you know, a person in, you know, it could have been. I'm not ruling it out definitely, because their hands are all over everything.
Right.
But I think that it was someone who had to know their tactics.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the point about that to me is that when I say agency involvement, I don't necessarily mean that, you know, it's a guy who specifically collects a paycheck from the Central Intelligence Agency every week, okay? Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that there are people in the intelligence community that certainly had their hands in all three of those assassinations.
Yeah, if not the assassination, the cover-up, definitely, in every case.
Oh, without question there. You know, my supposition might fall apart about, you know, them being involved in all three, but as far as the cover-ups go, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't doubt that. I mean, I know for sure that there were, I mean, I know you do too, and I'm sure a lot of people out there listening do, that there were agency people in each case. I mean, they were, whether agency or FBI, or another thing that I have tried to focus on lately was ex-FBI. If you look at the agency, so far I found 9 different members of the agency in different positions that were all ex-FBI. So one way to look at that is Hoover had a pretty good line on a lot of agency information.
Right, and this stuff was so intermingled, which Hoover wanted. I mean, Hoover...
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is...
he planted his people all over the place.
You got it. And just like the CIA... And the CIA learned from Hoover.
Yeah.
You know, they learned how to do a lot of this kind of infiltration stuff from the FBI, and that's not to say that Hoover was, you know, this great lawman or anything like that. Believe me, I'm not here to tell you that. But the fact is that when it came to, you know, keeping his intelligence networks intact, the man was a mastermind.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that Hoover, the agency did their best, but Hoover outplayed them many times. You know, he had... Not only did he have the extra time, having started in the 30s, but he had the intimidation factor of his files as well that the agency didn't have.
Right, and in the same breath, I can say that also the agency played off of him occasionally. I mean, he knew he was snowed by them more than once, especially regarding the Mexico City incident.
Yeah.
You know, so this is games being played back and forth among these guys, and it's hard to sort it out, you know?
Definitely. I think that they're one of the biggest problems with the case, and I think a lot of people get confused. Myself, too. We all, you know, have our moments where it doesn't make any sense because there's so many plots on top of each other. You know, it's like in Mexico City. You've got the camera operations that they got going on. You got 2 agency infiltration agents in the Soviet embassy. You've got people, you know, giving them phone taps from the Cuban embassy. And with all this net of different plots going on and all these people everywhere, nobody sees Oswald, and not a single picture gets taken.
Yeah, right. Which leads me to believe that that he wasn't there.
I support that as well. I don't think he showed to either. I don't think he showed up to either embassy. I think that it's possible, and I think that people want to claim that Sylvia Duran saw him, but she didn't give a description of Oswald. She gave a description of a shorter, blonde, red-faced man.
Right, which doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't think that a lot of people also say he was impersonated a bunch of times. I think that it's possible, you know, other people may have used his name because somebody used the name Oswald. And as Winston Scott pointed out, but the rest of the agency didn't listen, one of the calls, the guy used Spanish, and Oswald didn't speak Spanish.
Yeah, there's a problem there, you know. English being his first language, and then allegedly he could speak Russian, but nobody can account for the fact that this guy was speaking perfect Spanish on the wiretap.
Yeah.
You know,
More to me like a Cuban exile than it does Oswald.
It sure does, and that guy would not likely have that blonde hair and red face we were just talking about either.
Exactly, so that's somebody else.
So we've got, you know, a composite of people that they are saying is Oswald, and meanwhile they have no tangible proof of it.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's my, and that's, you know, it goes back to the why did they destroy things, the tapes. If they had proof that Oswald was there, you know, undisputable proof, why destroy it? If you've got pictures, why aren't there any?
Oh, right, especially because, I mean, the media immediately put out, you know, as fast as they could, the recording, you know, from New Orleans, you know, him espousing communist views, you know. So they would have been more than happy, and the commission could have had their job made a lot easier had they been able to put a picture of him standing in Mexico City going to the, you know, to the consulate or the embassy either way, you know, which, by the way, are two different things, although they were on the same compounds, you know, in that particular location. But either way, these things were well monitored, and if the CIA had these photographs or had some, they would have used them.
Yep.
That's all there is to it, except they didn't.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's one of the big problems over and over you see with the commission is they keep making assumptions that they don't have the evidence for.
Right. Now, the next thing that is on your list here, and I, and you know, hate to do this to you, but I mean, I do want to move it along a little bit. I think we definitely handled that whole issue. But when everybody talks about the Jim Garrison investigation, which for the most part, I think he absolutely did a lot of good. I support, not, you know, not to the degree that a lot of other people do, the work that he did and everything else, but he was set up to fail.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's no doubt about that. But one of the most interesting things that came out of the Garrison investigation, of course, was the nexus related to Guy Bannister. For people that don't know who Guy Bannister was,
definitely. I think that as far as Bannister, you know, there's been a lot of legend that got built up around him, unfortunately, but there was truth in some of Garrison's allegations. And I think that I respect Garrison for what he tried to do because he was a lone prosecutor basically going against the government. And he didn't have the tools that we have now. So, and we all make mistakes. We all need to realize that, too. I think, unfortunately, there's some people in our community that won't admit their mistakes. And if we don't admit our mistakes, we're just going to keep making them because we're going off of false presumptions. So I think that Garrison did a really good job with what he had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that all of his ideas were correct. But I think that with no, you know, I mean, with little help at all and people sending him money in the mail, he did a damn fine job.
Well, right, and it's not to say that he was, you know, the maniac that people like to portray him as, and he certainly wasn't the character that Kevin Costner played, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But he was an interesting guy, and I think if he had access, you know, if he wasn't being played directly by the agency, you know, I think he would have done a whole lot more damage.
Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is some of the things that the agency and the State Department did to try to obstruct his investigation.
Right.
For instance, the agency was keeping track of not only were they keeping track of Abraham Bolden at the time,
mm-hmm.
but they were also keeping track of Garrison and the people he was questioning and trying to intercept them, basically, to get information that they might have before Garrison even got his hands on them. The State Department, as far as you remember when Dr. Fink said the thing about there was a general and that got turned into it was a general commanding everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what it really was, basically what I've been able to find from the evidence I've seen, is that there was a general there that was told to control some of the army photographers that were not basically listening to orders. So that, to me, makes a lot more sense than there was a general there ordering everyone around with higher-ranking people there. I don't really see a general commanding the entire, you know, it was... If somebody was in charge of that autopsy, they weren't doing a very good job.
No, whoever was in charge of that autopsy needed to be fired because the whole thing was, you know, a cluster F, as it were. So,
yeah.
You know, and even the documentation there is ridiculous. But back to Guy Bannister.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We
no problem. I do that all the time, Carmine. It's okay. But I want to get through these because I think all of these things are really great. So
Bannister, as you know, Garrison.
Ed Asner in the film JFK, by the way. The guy who most famously winds up whipping up on Jack Lemmon with a pistol, which is based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that guy's name was Jack...
Martin?
Martin, thank you. Mm-hmm. Jack Martin actually was the guy who Jack Lemmon was playing. And, you know, Jack Lemmon played him pretty good, I think.
Yeah, oh, no, Jack Lemmon's a great actor.
Absolutely, and Ed Asner did a pretty good job on Bannister, from what I understand. But, of course, Bannister had died, you know, before Garrison's investigation really got underway and everything else. But this is an interesting thing about Bannister and his ties to the Cuban exile activities.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bannister, as we know, had many interesting connections. Among them were that he worked with Sergio, I never get this right, is it Arcacha?
Arcacha, yeah.
Sylvia Arcacha Smith, and he helped him set up, basically Bannister did background checks for Arcacha Smith to recruit people from local colleges. And then Bannister helped him basically set up one of the many exile organizations that Arcacha Smith was using to fund his activities. So, after that, as most people know, Bannister eventually also was an investigator with David Ferry for Marcello. Mm-hmm. And Bannister was accused often of being either a CIA informant or a CIA agent. And, of course, that was always attacked by officials. They always said it was untrue, that there was no connection between Bannister and the CIA. Well, it turns out there was.
Yeah.
Turns out they lied.
Yeah, just like, you know, Clay Shaw had nothing to do with the agency either.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and once again, though, I think with Shaw, it was they were so frightened of Garrison being able to prove that he was right that anyone with any connection whatsoever, they just outright denied. It didn't matter whether it was an important connection or not. They just didn't want to give Garrison anything.
Oh, right. And even if Clay Shaw had simply been, you know, just somebody who was debriefed by the CIA and had been a source of information or whatever, I think they were absolutely terrified that any sort of a realistic public line could have been drawn to the agency from the assassination.
Yep.
That you know, that explains all a whole lot of the activity there against Garrison's investigation. Which I still find very, very sad, you know, because,
yeah.
Again, I say if he had even, you know, 10% of the information that we have today.
Oh, yeah, it would have been a whole different game.
Would have been a whole different game. Yeah, exactly. So.
So with Bannister was, in fact, a CIA informant. They actually considered using his detective agency as a front, but decided to use a different one. So. Mm-hmm. Again, chalk up another one. They lied.
Well, right. Big surprise. And that's not to say that he wasn't involved in gun running. That's not to say he wasn't involved in underworld activities. This guy had his hands in a lot of stuff, Bannister. He dealt with, you know, underworld figures, as it were, quite directly. He was a former FBI guy.
Just another one of those ex-FBI guys that seems to be all over the place.
Yeah, big coincidence, right?
Yeah.
So now we get into a little something more interesting, I think, because Jack Ruby, to me, is one of the most, just, I don't know how to put it, it's like you're walking into black holes, you know, with this guy, because it's all over the place. He's like Swiss cheese when it comes to knocking out, you know, holes into the official story,
mm-hmm.
right? The official story, he's just a lone nut who sympathized with, you know, Jackie Kennedy and wanted to make sure she didn't come down to have to, you know, explain what she saw for the trial.
Exactly, because she wasn't traumatized from watching her husband's head explode next to her.
Well, yeah, that wouldn't be trauma. Having to come and explain it back in Dallas, though, might be. Yeah, and Jack Ruby really cared about that.
Yeah, all of a sudden.
Right. Yeah, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, after seemingly having no interest in politics. Okay. But here's the thing. For years and years, people that want to support the commission's assertions have said that Jack Ruby had nothing to do with anybody. He was just a local thug who, you know, wasn't involved with mob people, wasn't involved with any agency, and so on and so forth. But what do we have here?
Well, also to add to your thing about the official declarations that he wasn't involved with anyone, Hoover signed an affidavit saying that Oswald and Ruby had no connection whatsoever to the FBI. Well, he lied.
Yeah, big shocker there. And this has been a long time contention, is that, well, Ruby didn't know Oswald. It had nothing to do with it. It really is this crazy, you know, one lone nut happened to whack another lone nut, end of story.
Instead, we find that Jack Ruby was an FBI informant. He was a criminal FBI informant who gave them information about the mafia.
Yeah, yeah. And not because he was a primary mob figure, not because he was a made guy, as it were, which is absolutely impossible considering the fact that, you know, who he was and where he came from and everything else. Yeah. The fact is, though, that he did business with them.
Often. And he had friends. I was talking to you earlier about, I went and ate in Campisi's restaurant, and they were friends of him, and the family still owns the place.
Yeah, right. And tell everybody who Joseph Campisi was.
Joe Campisi was one of the mob players in Dallas. He reported basically up the chain. Eventually, he had some dealings with Carlos Marcello. Campisi was a friend of Ruby's who came and visited him a few days after he killed Oswald in jail for apparently a personal visit.
Right, and descriptions of Campisi that I have grown to understand over the years range from boss of a small area to underboss.
Yeah, he was basically a very powerful racketeer.
Yeah, right, he was definitely higher up on the food chain. This is not some mob foot soldier we're talking about.
No, definitely not. He was at least, I would be willing to contend with you that he was an underboss at least.
Okay, right, exactly where I was going with it, is that at the very least we're talking about an underboss for a major area. Not to say that Dallas was the major focus of that, but Dallas was part of the area that Campisi was involved in. And just another little footnote, who decided to visit Jack Ruby in prison, Carmine?
Mr. Campisi.
After he killed Oswald, we're talking exactly. About.
For, as I said, a personal visit, supposedly.
And you know what? I believe it was. Because he knew him. This wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, well, let me go see this guy because I might have heard of him before.
Yeah.
No, this was, I'm going to go visit my friend. Yeah. Now, as for whether he told his friend to make sure he keeps his mouth shut, or as for whether he told his friend, look, they got you for this other thing, but remember, don't talk about us because we can still get to you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? I wouldn't speculate as to exactly what was said. I just know that it's not a coincidence.
Oh, no, and I'm not speculating either. I'm just offering possibilities.
No, I know. I agree with you that there's all sorts of interesting possibilities that could have happened, and I don't think any of them are outside of the realm of possibility, because we have Hoover lying again, and not only is he lying that Ruby doesn't have a connection to the mafia, he's lying that Ruby has a connection to the Bureau.
Right.
So that, once again, I think, you know, we can try to figure out exactly why he lied, but that he lied is definitely notable, and that he didn't just lie to the public, he lied to the commission.
No, precisely. And it's endless with that stuff, is, you know, and look, I could even say that the motive, because you said, you know, we can speculate about why, or we can try and investigate and see a different, you know, a different perspective as to why this was done.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that even if we go with the most innocuous explanation possible,
There's still no good answer.
And the most innocuous thing I can think of is, I don't want my agency embarrassed that we knew that this guy was a loose cannon.
Yeah.
You know, that's the most innocuous thing I can come up with.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely believe that it was, at the very minimum, they feared their agencies would be destroyed.
Right.
Because Hoover, it wasn't necessarily just the assassination. He had been doing illegal operations since the 50s. He had been spying on people illegally, and COINTELPRO, all the other various programs that were illegal he was operating, would have all come out.
Right, and to start to reveal your informants and to give people an idea that there's a network of informants, and then
power.
Yeah, it would have absolutely taken away the the nature of the operations. It would have caused a whole big ripple effect in his agency. So even if it was an innocuous need to deny, it's still a denial, and yeah. I'm not buying the innocuous part either, because we're talking about J. Edgar Hoover.
I don't think J. Edgar Hoover did anything innocuously.
Very good. Okay, see, I'm just, you know, and I know I'm talking a lot, but I mean, I see the same things you're seeing in these documents, okay?
So, yeah, I'm glad. Trust me, I debate these things so often, it's nice just to have someone who agrees.
And believe me, if you say something that I think is way off, I'm more than happy to talk to you about it too. But it
well,
just so
worry.
Happens.
There won't be any confetti cannons, I promise.
Thank you. And please no Jimmy Sutton. Okay, sorry. I did it again. I can't help it. Okay. So, okay. Now, there's two documents here.
Yep.
Okay. Now, this is weird because people talk about this a lot, relating to Ruth Payne. Okay, and I'll tell you what. Why don't I just let you go through this and explain the relevance of these, and I'll pick up the links and drop them into the chat as well.
Okay. Basically, these documents are – I was able to – I've often talked to people about one of my big problems with the commission investigation was the timeline holes. The timeline repeatedly has areas where they never explained what happened. They just made an assumption and jumped over the time. You know, you'll find one around the time when between 12 and 12:30. They don't know where Oswald was exactly, so they just jump.
Yeah,
when
well,
the shooting starts.
Well, why not, you know?
So, once again, now this one I think As important as that one is, I think this one is very important as well, too, because it kind of slashes their case to a much smaller time scale than they imagined. I think that with all the information going back and forth and all the people involved in the commission investigation, no one ever really sat down and said, okay, does all of our evidence allow for all of this to happen in the time frame we're setting? So
right.
What the documents show is, first of all, Oswald could not have planned to have been in the depository until Ruth Payne told him about the job in October. So anything before that date when he knew doesn't have anything to do with the assassination directly.
All
if,
right.
If he Got was a lone gunman.
Okay. Now, there are people who say, that, you know, this is all irrelevant because it was all last-minute planning on his part.
Oh, I know.
and that's all there is to it. He only decided to bring the gun the day before. That's why he made that unscheduled visit at Ruth Payne's house and all this other stuff.
Yep.
It is arguable.
Oh no, it is totally arguable, but I'm just looking at the information the commission gave us.
Right.
The commission said that it was the chance meeting or the chance occurrence that she told him about the job. So without that chance occurrence, he doesn't know about the job. Thus,
right.
He cannot be in the depository in October unless she tells him.
Right.
So, I mean, people can argue about it, but those are the dates we were given by the commission.
Well, right, and I happen to believe that, you know, the whole story about Lenny Mae Randall,
mm-hmm.
You know, basically saying, well, gee, you know, he needs a job, here you go. That all sounds pretty logical and normal to me.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't see any problem. I don't think they saw one either.
Now, there's some contention that, yeah, really, and there's some contention that Ruth Payne purposely, didn't give him other job leads and only gave him that one. Now, I'm willing to entertain that idea because, you know, Ruth Payne is
a questionable character, perhaps.
at the very least, right? You know, she didn't even want to explain that her, you know, her sister worked for the agency and, you know,
her
and she's...
Her father was almost recruited by the agency and...
Or that, you know, prior to going to talk to the HSCA, she wanted to make sure that she could review her own testimony, you know, to make sure she kept her story straight a couple of years later.
Or that the alleged Walker note would have never been found until she turned over all that stuff to the DPD later on.
Oh, yeah, but there's plenty of helpful people like, you know, Patricia, what was her name at the time? I forget, but later on, McMillan, right?
Yeah, I wanted to establish that first. So it can be stated based on the commission's timeline, he can't have the job until October when she tells him, thus he cannot plan to be in the depository until October.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've cut down the commission's timeline that used to be months long to just over a month.
Correct.
Okay, now we come to the next problem. The Forrest Sorrells, who was in charge of developing the parade route for the motorcade, didn't finalize it until the 18th of November. And it wasn't announced in the newspapers until the 19th of November. So the earliest Oswald could have known that Kennedy was going to pass the building he worked in was the 19th of November. That leaves him 72 hours or less to do everything.
Mm. And isn't that fascinating? Because people have tried to say that the route was published well in advance, but there's no evidence for that.
Nope. The commission tells us the 19th was the earliest it was published.
Mm-hmm.
So they have painted themselves into what I like to call an evidentiary corner.
All right. And of course, you have to make the assumption that Oswald saw it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, let's give them all the help they need. Let's say that he did see it, right? Let's say that he came across at 5 o'clock when they first came out. He saw it as soon as it came out. Now, here's the real problem. 72 hours, he doesn't really have 72 hours because now he has to sleep for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And then he has to eat. And he has to interact with other people. And he has to go to work. So roughly he has, in my estimation, between 24 and 48 hours maximum. To plot, to come up with a motive that the commission could never prove, and to make not a single mistake, all the way from the Payne house to the depository, never being seen, taking the weapon apart and putting it in the bag, never being seen putting it back together, no one ever walking in on him while he did anything in connection with it.
Right, and of course, scoring a headshot with a weapon that he didn't even bother to sight in after reassembling.
Well, but, and now that he has only 72 hours, he didn't have time to practice either.
Oh, well, for practice, there's no evidence that he practiced at all in the 2 years leading up.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree with. I had written an article prior that talked about he had no feasible practice for the months before, but this basically knocks all that out of the water. He has no time whatsoever. And a problem with that is the Carcano trigger mechanism requires firing practice to use it accurately and quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes more time that he doesn't have.
That's correct. You could actually get off the shots in the prescribed amount of time, regardless of whatever your calculations are, but that requires some practice.
Indeed it does. Mm-hmm. At least a few times.
Oh, right. And for a guy who wasn't exactly the most skilled marksman in the world, big problem.
Yep. Well, you know, people talk about commission supporters often like to say he was a sharpshooter, and that was true in 1956. But mm-hmm. in 1959, he wasn't a sharpshooter anymore. He was a marksman. So it's easily demonstrable that his skill went down without practice. So now add a couple more years on and give him less than 72 hours to come up with a plan.
Oh, right. And nobody has any evidence that he even had any sort of spare ammunition. He wasn't going to firing ranges despite, you know, a couple of supposed sightings. You know, I think that those things are kind of...
Well, I don't think he ever was... The commission, in one part of the commission, they talk about that none of those sightings were able to be proven.
Right, because quite often he would be in two places at once, according to the sightings.
And the weapon was usually different, too. The Wood family, who said they saw him at the firing range,
mm-hmm.
The weapon shot fire out of the front of it. So it was a Carcano, but it wasn't his.
Well, right, because his only sprayed, you know, from his stuff sprayed from the chamber. That's where his problem was. The gas was coming out of the chamber when Fraser bench fired it. It was all over the, you know, the other side of the gun, not where we would have the fire coming out of the front of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a serious inconsistency with the weapon. But anyway, moving forward. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. So yeah, basically the next part is the Oswald chronology. And like I said, he had the 24 to 48 hours. And now you have to subtract what he did when he was at the Paynes. Because when he went to go supposedly, you know, prepare for his big night before the assassination, you know, what did he do? What would an assassin do? Maybe they'd practice. Maybe they'd, you know, at least dry fire, go somewhere and try to get their head together. No, he didn't do that. He went to the Paynes' house, had dinner with the Paynes. He watched some TV, played with his daughter, and went to bed early.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, this is the guy who's preparing, supposedly, to kill the president the next day.
Well, and you know what a commission supporter tells you is that, well, he left his wedding band behind. He left a lot of his money behind, assuming that he'd never come back and all of that. Now, the weird thing about this to me has always been, why would you leave the handgun at the rooming house and bring the rifle to work by itself?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a good question. Another question I think that is valid, too, that some supporters of the commission aren't fans of is, why didn't he leave Dallas?
Right.
Don't you run? Why do you stay to be apprehended? He had plenty of time. If he could get out of the building in 3 minutes, I dare say he could have gotten out of Dallas in 20.
Mm. No, but instead he takes a bus and then grabs a cab. And
and then comes back into town. He never
right.
leaves.
Right. So a guy with no escape plan, with no backup weapon to shoot his way out of the situation, was really well planned. And then, of course, you know, guys like McAdams, they like to tell you, well, he wasn't planned out. That's the thing. He just kind of did this all spur of the moment.
And well, they will say that, but that doesn't wash with their prior knowledge. See, until until we could ascertain exactly what his timeline was, they always assumed he had plenty of time to plot, but he doesn't.
Right.
So without all that time to plot, unless he has help, chances are he couldn't do it.
That's the point, though, isn't it?
Indeed. It's, you know, and it's just going to get worse as we find... I plan on getting every minute of those 3 days and finding as close as I can an approximation to how much time he had. And I'm sorry, but I don't think 24 to 48 already is enough. Because, yeah, he could have... People say, well, we could have thought about it at work. True. He could have made the plot in his head at work. Unfortunately, where's the motive? Did it just come to him? He was just like, oh, well, I guess I'll kill the president. You know, it takes time to build a motive. You can't just... It's possible. But once again, you know, anything is possible.
Well, you know, Carmine, and you know I'm planting my tongue firmly in the side of my cheek when I say this. But, you know, he really was such a disgruntled little fellow that he was just angry enough to take a shot at the country that he felt wasn't recognizing him for the great person that he believed he was.
Exactly.
You know.
I've heard that one as well. And once again, you know, I'll give them, let them, you know, assume that that is what happened, but that's not what the evidence infers, in my opinion. The evidence infers a whole lot of other things that don't have anything to do with a man with not enough time. You know, anything is possible, but if you look at any other I mean, this wasn't just, was it Zaranga or the guy who went after Teddy Roosevelt? You know, that was a crazy person. He just showed up at an event and he started shooting with a handgun at, you know, close range.
Or even Godot, who,
yeah.
You know, was that Garfield, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think Godot shot Garfield and pretty much it was the same kind of thing. You know, everybody, I mean, from John Wilkes Booth through those guys... You know, the only guy that I ever saw or heard of that didn't pretty much say, that's right, I did it, was Oswald.
Yeah, and, well, and he also was the only person, for some reason, that used a long-range weapon.
Yeah, well, you know, of course. Well, that's because...
I'm sorry, you were saying?
No, it's okay. Of course, that's because, you know, he was such a coward that, you know. But this is the thing, though. They get involved in these arguments where they say, you know, well, this is why it makes sense. But for somebody to want to get their – I'll take their argument at face value for a second. For somebody to want to get their name into the history books, okay, for somebody who wants to be recognized for the big man he is because he just killed, you know, the president of the United States – when you got those microphones shoved in your face, tell me that that's not the perfect opportunity to go, that's right, I am an efficient assassin.
Exactly. And why wouldn't he have done it at close range? You know, why wouldn't he have wanted everyone to see him do it, if that was his motivation?
there's another point. Why not just stand on the curb and when Kennedy walked, you know, drove by, just boom. Yeah.
I mean, there. You know, I'm not saying that. You know, because I'm sure this is what detractors of that argument would say. They would say that, you know, well, there's no definitive proof, and that's true. You know, like you were saying earlier, I try to hold myself to a high standard, but I think we should expect it of people who debate with us as well. You know, a lot of people just want to argue about personal things, or they want to distract and talk about everything but the subject. And the problem with the commission is, you know, just from the documents we've discussed already prior, they were compromised from the beginning. You know, you can't to say that their investigation was a good one is a mistake, because it wasn't a good investigation. A good investigation would have considered all the evidence. A good investigation wouldn't have allowed the officials that were running it to compromise.
Yeah, and I've even heard them try and say, and I know you have some knowledge about this, although we didn't plan on discussing this, I've even heard them say that, you know, the Dallas Police Department actually did a really remarkably good job. And I hang my head at that point. I don't know how to respond to that because, I've tortured myself with reading that stuff, okay, from the Dallas police files. I took the time to talk to about 50 different police officers.
Wow.
Okay? And, you know, between the fact, and if you want to see a real conglomeration of you know, Excedrin headache number something, take a look at Larry Sneed's book, right?
Mm-hmm.
No More Silence, where he I think he talks to something like 200 of them. You find these guys crossing over with claiming that they were involved in events where, you know, it takes one guy to do this, but yet three guys are saying they did it. You have different guys filing reports and telling me quite candidly.
We wouldn't have pretty much known where anything was.
Right, and even Decker's, you know, investigation was rife with all this stuff too. I mean, you know, he took statements from people that that made no sense. I mean, and Fritz, although he was supposed to be a great interrogator, and I'm not going to say he wasn't, never kept proper notes. I mean, you know, if you even talked to Bill Alexander, you would have found out that this guy would pull pieces of paper out of his pocket during trials.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's kind of like the pre-written statement and everything they had for Beal Frazier.
Yeah, exactly.
They were looking for a man to blame this on. They didn't care who that man was. They just needed somebody to take the blame and take the heat off of them. And, you know, I understand. I really don't. A lot of people try to attach nefarity to what they did, and I don't. I think that, for the most part, it was incompetence, massive incompetence. And I think that there were definitely people high up who, I'm sure, helped in whatever way they could to suppress things so that they didn't look so bad. But that was basically done as soon as, you know, I mean, you got Wade announcing the wrong weapon type.
Right, exactly.
And who is another former FBI, by the way.
Well, yeah, and Wade is an interesting character in and of himself. Of course, we find out later that this guy railroaded a whole bunch of people, so he was perfect for the job. You know, and somebody brought up in chat, well, what about the pristine bullet on the stretcher? Yeah, there's another instance, and in fact, I can argue with you that it wasn't even found on the stretcher they said it was found on.
Yep, it was on one or the other, two stories.
Yeah, right, and most likely it was probably on Ronald Fuller's stretcher,
mm-hmm.
You know.
I have no doubt. Once again, the chain of custody was totaled by then. You know, they if you look at the testimony, of the six people who the commission claimed were the chain of people who found the bullet, one of six said it was the same bullet. The rest couldn't be sure.
Oh, well, right, and it wasn't in exactly pristine condition. I will say this, just because I'm watching the commentary in the chat room again. You know, there is damage to the bullet, but it is far too intact.
Yeah.
To have been the missile that did all of the damage that is ascribed to it. This is what the problem is. And it does, you know, from one angle, it does look, you know, pristine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly pristine, and not just because of the little notch on the top, because now we know where that came from.
Yeah.
But because, you know, the back of the bullet is damaged some. You know, but the missile is entirely intact, which is also weird because we know factually from the rest of the evidence that was collected that bullets that were allegedly from the same weapon did not survive breaking, you know, less than half of the bones that were ascribed to the magic bullet. So good point there.
Well, and if you look, too, it's not just often people who support the single bullet theory like to say that all the officials were behind it. They weren't. In fact, most of the medical officials were not, if you count Parkland and Bethesda. And even at Bethesda, you had Humes in testimony saying that he didn't think it was the same bullet that did the damage because it was in too good of shape. And then you had Fink saying that it was impossible because of all the damage that was caused.
Well, right. And at one point even saying that, you know, based on the amount of debris that was left behind by the bullet, it doesn't seem to have come from that bullet.
Yep.
You know, and these are the doctors that, you know, did
basically, back their case.
You know, and they backed the case for the most part, but mostly with their own ineptness, because, I mean, there's all kinds of problems with the medical examination.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you didn't, you know, you got them doing the 1 hour follow up because they screwed up in the autopsy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then, of course, there's the question of the brain. You know,
was it ever weighed? Were the numbers ever entered originally? No, in a lot of cases.
Well, and we also know that the documents that we're confronted with right now, which are presented to us as the original autopsy, cannot possibly be.
Well, yeah. Another, you know, I mean, you might hear when people debate about the pictures, you know, all the inconsistencies with the photographic record as far as the autopsy goes. Well, there wouldn't be any inconsistencies if they had to make two sets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there was one set and the White House had to develop a version and then Acosta had to develop a version, then maybe there'd be less inconsistencies. Now, add to that, you've got missing pictures, and then you've got people with the internet slapping up and changing pictures. So that's why there's so many unknowable pictures out there.
Yeah, well, right. And I got a hold of mine from the Fox set, which is a whole weird story to begin with. But, you know, that's what I got. And meanwhile, they're pretty good representations from my understanding of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the originals. But now all this stuff that's been spread around and convoluted on the internet, you know, most people are looking at things and seeing things in these photographs that simply aren't there.
Yeah.
Because somebody's been toying with them.
Exactly. They've either been toyed with or it just requires too much interpretation. I talked to you about before, I keep myself to the documents because they require very little interpretation and most people can understand them without too much explanation.
Well, right.
Unless you're an expert, it's a lot harder and it's very subjective.
Right. And I'll make my admission about, you know, about these documents and you know, sometimes they are confusing, but if you want to get yourself thoroughly confused, yeah, go ahead and look at the autopsy photographs. Because,
yeah.
You know, the alleged mystery photograph, as it were, you know, that one that our friend Michael Bobbin couldn't properly orient.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that thing is confusing to me, and I've been looking at that for two decades.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you just look at all the medical procedures, you know, they could have done such a better job, and they just chose not to. For instance, the X-rays. If you look at Ebersol's AARB testimony, he talks about how they had crystal clear precision images if they would have taken him to the X-ray department. Did they do that? No. It's not like it's an important case. It's just the president. Why don't you bring in the portable that has distortion problems?
Yeah, that was the other bizarre thing there, is that they brought in this really crappy portable X-ray machine. And those X-rays, I've had somebody look at those, and they can't believe the terrible quality, even in the time period it was.
Yeah, it was just a matter of rolling them down the hall. But didn't want to, I guess.
Well, right, and I don't think Jack would have complained, you know.
And then you've got that it's basically, it's a circus, because you've got over 20 people coming in and out, making phone calls, talking to each other. I mean, how are you going to conduct a real medical investigation with 20 people in the room?
Right, and that's one of the things that I, you know, although I've got my problems with Gerald Custer's characterizations of what went on that night, I 100% believe his interpretation of exactly how chaotic the scene was.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, imagine any room with 20-plus people, and then try to do a thorough scientific examination in it.
Yeah, try and do a thorough examination of a rock in a room with 20 people, and you got a problem. Meanwhile, this is a human body. So, look, Carmine, believe it or not, we're down to the last, say, 7 or 8 minutes here. And I want to, again, you know, and can you believe 2 hours just went by?
Nope.
But it actually has, and I'm really, really grateful that you decided to join me tonight.
My pleasure, Chuck.
We went off onto a couple of different trails away from the documents, but we did cover the documents. I kind of wish we had time to really cover that CIA document about dealing with the media, because that's one of the points that I like to make all the time, is that, you know, the agencies definitely have control over their assets in the media, and guess what? They are many, and they always have been many. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily – it's the domestic programs I have a problem with. I don't care if the agency wants to use its tricks abroad. It's just when they use them domestically in violation of their charter I have a problem with.
Well, see, but the whole thing is in violation of their charter. You know, they're not supposed to operate domestically at all.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, yeah, if anything, among their biggest problems, in my opinion, in the 60s was JM Wave.
Yeah, which, you know, huge CIA station in Florida, thanks,
yeah.
You know, on the mainland of a country you're not supposed to be operating in. And plus, let's not forget that the original mandate was essentially the collection and sort of collation of intelligence. It wasn't supposed to be assassination plots. It wasn't supposed to be, you know, all these criminal operations which have led us into other nexuses out there, okay?
Yes.
You know, and I don't know how you feel about this stuff, but I mean, I feel very solid in saying that, you know, we're looking at an agency that has been involved in everything from murder to drug trafficking.
Oh, definitely. And there's evidence of all of it. I mean, in what was it? The former head of the CIA, not McCone, but William, why can't I remember his name? He was
Casey?
Casey, thank you. But, yeah, he was station chief in Saigon during Vietnam, and he talked about them admitting to at least 20,000 illegal deaths.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I mean, if this is the former head of the CIA admitting that they ran drug programs and killed people, I'm going to give his word some value.
Right, and of course, you know, he dies under mysterious circumstances, too.
Don't get me started on that. That's you know what? I'm more than willing to look into that, but I have been having just the most tiresome debate as of late with people about mysterious deaths, because there's lists out there that shoot over 100, and there is no way. I mean, just the, like we're talking about the compartmentalized size of a plot.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to kill hundreds of people. That attracts attention.
No, absolutely, and I agree with you 100% there, although I will tell you that, you know, the death of somebody like DeMorin Shields?
Oh, Yeah, no, I think there are definitely cases to be made. I would just... Mm-hmm. My whole thing is that there has to be a better context to them instead of just making where, unfortunately, in one case at least, I see a very bad set of people put together because, you know, it's just anyone that could have had any sort of tangential connection. It doesn't really have to do with anything, and that doesn't make any sense. You don't need to kill a bunch of peripheral witnesses. You need
right.
to kill the people who know things.
You know, the guy who happened to, you know, walk Jack Ruby's dog, Jack Ruby's lawyer's dog, you know, a couple of years prior, you know, it's really, it's yeah. gotten out of control.
Yeah, we are reporters that talked about Kennedy at one point or another who die of some, you know, or the people that want to say, you know, every heart attack or every case of cancer, like Jack Ruby's cancer. People get cancer. It happens. It doesn't have to be weaponized. It doesn't have to be special. You know, there's no magical, you know, they can fake deaths, yes, but is there a context and a necessity to doing so? Like, for instance, Johnny Roselli, I've debated with people, I would say he is a feasible person to have been a mysterious death. One, he was murdered, which I always think is a good way to start the list, and he knew about all the Castro plots. He was connected directly to Verona and some of the other Cuban exile leaders. You know, he knew about agency motivations and agency tactics. He was seen over and over with William Harvey, even after they commanded Harvey not to associate with him.
Well, I'll tell you this. When it comes to Roselli, though, there are a lot of reasons why he could have ended up in that drum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
there
so...
were Cubans that the police were investigating associated with his death.
No, absolutely. So there is a lot of reasons why he could have ended up dead. It may not have to do with that nexus, you know. And I'm not saying that it doesn't.
His testimony too, I think, is a factor, perhaps.
Right, but what I'm saying is that there are other possibilities there.
Oh yes, definitely.
And when it comes to Jack Ruby, though, I got to disagree with you a little bit because I feel like that, you know, that's kind of coincidental timing. You know, considering where his where his appeals were going and everything else. You know, and just the year in which he died, I mean, I don't know, it just seems like a bit much.
Well, yeah, know? No, I'm not saying that there's going to be occasions where I would agree it does, you know, for instance, the coincidences about Oswald, it does stretch believability.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't, you know, there are the chances. I just think with Ruby, there was no need. If they were going to kill him, they would have done right afterwards.
Why yes. Wait? Yeah, see, that's the good argument against the possibility that he was one of those, you know, staged events. Okay, look, before we run completely out of time, Carmine, I want you to once again give your website and also point people to the Facebook group because we're just about out of time.
Okay. The website again for the book is tpaak.com, T-P-A-A-K.com. The Facebook page is Facebook.com/NeepMG with a capital MG at the end. I also want to say that if you get a chance, please go to the Mary Farrell Foundation website. And if you see the new cryptonyms update for the cryptonym project, some of the cryptonyms that I've submitted as a contributor are listed there too. That's one of the things I also have been trying to do is update a list of cryptonyms so other researchers can use them as a reference aid to help them figure out things as well.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to mention, because she was kind enough to mention me before, Gail Nix Jackson and the Missing Nix film, her book. Please have a look at that. That's another great book out there. And I want to thank all of the independent researchers that have helped me out, and as much as they might not want to hear it, all of the people I've debated, because they've taught me something, too, if only how not to debate.
Right, exactly. Two princes and a king, all about how JFK, RFK, and MLK can be examined, and I'm really looking forward to this. About when is that book going to come to fruition?
It's going to be this year. I'm going to try to get it out as soon as possible. I just want to – one of the things about the book I'm trying to do is I've noticed, and this is just my opinion, but there's a lot of books who I think the average person is not going to – want to get so in-depth into, like Buglielsi's tome.
Right. We don't want to get lost in the minutiae. We want to get at the ideas, get at the evidence, and get at what's really happening.
Exactly.
So,
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nope, no problem. I'm just going to wrap it up because my obnoxious bumper is just about to kick me in the face. So okay. I wanted to say that I want to thank Carmine Savastano for coming on with me tonight, and I urge you guys to check him out. And, hey, if you want to debate him, go ahead and do that too. I'm sure that you will find it a difficult task. I do enjoy you on Facebook, and also you can just find him on Facebook. Everybody, thanks for listening to the Ocelli Effect, and stay tuned to UCY.TV Radio. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
But I have the files. You know, I read the
really?
Sample in National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
all
that guy,
how can that be
possible?
The brain,
you
know,
all
the candles and the slab of choice. I don't know when that was. Internet, professional wrestler, and not Jesse Ventura style. It doesn't matter where the cartoon comes from, as long as it's real. It doesn't. It's hard to get real information because seriously, they think she's the best.